Theater, Oakland.
All right, we're going to leave it right there for now. Jeff Mackler, as always, we appreciate the good information and the incredible work you do for the people. Stay safe. See you soon.
KBOO.fm/give to make a contribution in support of the critical work of community radio. Thank you.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international acts. Sometimes they have bands play live, and it's all with the yelling and the screaming and the, I don't like my mom and dad or my teachers and all that kind of stuff. That's Life During Wartime, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Scene for KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland. Today, my guest is Colleen Kinder, essayist, teacher, author, who has just published Letter to a Stranger, Essays to the Ones That Haunt Us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Letter to a Stranger is an anthology of short letters written in the second person addressed to strangers that writers have met in passing. To begin, I'm wondering if you could tell us how you came up with the idea for this book.
This book dates back to a moment in the classroom that I had at Yale many years ago. I was hosting the travel writer Pico Iyer, and I had assigned many of his extraordinary travel essays to my students and had prepared lots of questions and had prompted my students to come ready to dig into the craft of his essays. And Pico sort of took control of the seminar and told us that instead he would tell us the stories behind his assignments, and that he would sort of what I call go off assignment, that he would take us into the more personal side of his stories. And I was really captivated with that side story approach that he brought to my classroom. And I noticed that my students also were exceptionally engaged with this legendary writer sitting down and saying, hey, here's the thing I never put into the official story. Here's the secret story that I've been carrying inside of me. And so I asked him in the seminar, have you ever written this version of the story, or have you ever thought about writing this version of the story? And when he said no, I detected some bit of maybe regret or dissatisfaction, and perhaps I was projecting because I'm a writer myself who always comes home with extra stories from assignments. But it really stuck with me, and I thought there should be a home for this kind of story. And I began reaching out to fellow writers and brainstorming with them. And there was so much enthusiasm among my peers. So many people said, when I come home from an assignment, I almost always feel like there's a better story that I'm not able to tell because it doesn't fit the parameters of my official assignment. So I started working on coming up with a publication that we named Off Assignment, and Letter to a Stranger was the flagship column for that publication. It was the column that was a space for stories about interactions with people who make a mark on you that is sort of mysterious. And from the beginning, once we started gathering stories and opening to submissions, it was definitely the column that picked up the most speed. It was, everyone seemed to have a stranger story.
Curious, why is it that these stories, which it seems like everybody is really excited to tell, and they're wonderful stories to read, why is that not part of official assignments?
That's a great question. I mean, I was just speaking today with a friend who is a travel writer, and she was just lamenting the fact that when you go on an assignment for a travel publication, you have to package the story ahead of time. It's like they have special issues and they're looking for you to meet their editorial needs. And you kind of have to sell the idea before you even go there, which is pretty wild in my opinion, because as we all know, that the serendipity is such a big part of what we discover in the world, and there's a degree of hubris and kind of control that I've never really related to with that structure of selling an idea before you actually go to a place. And I think sometimes editors at publications, you know, they have these issues in mind, and they expect their writers to fulfill what they promised before going on an assignment. So I think there's a little bit of a vacuum there. And that was what I was hoping to fill with this publication and this column.
It seems also a little bit antithetical to the nature of travel too, to decide in advance what the story is going to be before you actually go there and discover that story.
100%, Suzanne. I completely agree. And my experience with seeking out stories and traveling is always that things are extraordinarily different than what you first imagine them to be. And it's that kind of surrender to place and to serendipity that results in your best story.
Could you talk about some of the small letters that are in this book that make up Letter to a Stranger?
I love the essays in this book and have spent quite a bit of time with them by this point. Some of them are the kinds of stranger stories that you might expect. Elizabeth Colbert, an environmental journalist and New Yorker contributor, wrote to a Peruvian man who she encountered on an assignment in Peru, and somebody whose spirit made a mark on her and who was puzzling to her. But other writers have taken real liberties with the notion of stranger. For example, Indigenous writer Amber Meadow Adams wrote to her own grandmother, her deceased grandmother, who was forcibly educated at the Mohawk School in Ontario. And she visited the grounds of that school and wrote a really moving and transporting and devastating letter to her grandmother, who she connected with on that journey. So you get the whole gamut in this book. You get taxi drivers, you get folks met on subways, you get somebody at the Rwandan border who surprised Ted Conover while he was on assignment in that part of the world, but also some figures who perhaps fit the definition of stranger less obviously. Rachel Yoder, the novelist Rachel Yoder, wrote to a man who stalked her in high school in an essay that falls towards the end of the book and is quite a surprising story. And the very first letter to a stranger that knocked my socks off in terms of showcasing to me just how capacious this form could be and how wide-ranging the submissions we would get were was a submission by Carlin Houghton. And she wrote to a baby that she miscarried while on a road trip in upstate New York. And it's a stunning essay. It was chosen was shortlisted for Best American Essays in 2017, I believe. And it really assured me that writers can do so much with this form and that I would be endlessly surprised by what came my way as soon as I opened the door to these essays.
So based on this idea that you had, you co-founded Off Assignment, which is a nonprofit reading series and magazine devoted to, as you describe it, the personal narratives that lurk behind every news story. What do personal narratives add to our understanding of people and places that's different from more traditional travel writing or even news stories?
That's such a huge and important question. And the essay in this book that came to mind instantly when you said that was a piece set in Afghanistan that was written by Jamil John Kochai, a novelist. He is Afghani, and he wrote about an encounter with somebody who he assumed to be a member of the Taliban from far away. And then he ended up having this really warm, really almost like familial-like exchange with this stranger. And the way he wrote the letter was almost as like an apology, like, I'm sorry that I perceived you to be such a threat when it turns out you knew my family and we really connected. And I recently wrote to Jamil and said, you know, I really have no words for what's happening in Afghanistan, but you've been on my mind and your family is on my mind. And that essay that you wrote as a letter to a stranger has made me able to feel present and connected to Afghanistan in a way that I couldn't otherwise. And I really think that these stories of human encounters that we can all find an entryway into, these stories that focus on really basic human emotions, fear, surprise, affection, lust. Also, there are some great love stories in this book and stories of misconnections, which we all have in spades. But I think that stories about two people and the emotions that pass between them and the kind of messaging that happens between two people, even if they don't know each other's names, are so accessible to all of us and just enormously relatable.
I've heard it said before that we sometimes tell truths to strangers that we can't tell to people who know us. I'm wondering if you think that's true. And also, what is it about strangers that creates that kind of intimacy, do you think?
I love that question because I absolutely think it's true. And I think when I started this column, I would have expected the majority of Letter to a Stranger essays to be about precisely that. And I think I've been surprised that people are writing to strangers to cover all sorts of human emotions and experiences. And a couple people in the book, Anjali Sachdeva, a novelist, did write about that in the book. She wrote an awesome letter to a man that she met at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, who she felt this like aperture with while his family was lagging behind. And she had this really sacred few minutes with him where they talked about what it means to have kids and how once you have kids, there's no going back. It's like jumping off of a cliff, which I think is a wonderfully appropriate metaphor for a setting of the Grand Canyon. But that essay resounds with me so much because that's always been my experience when I travel. I feel like if I'm in a cab with a driver who's taking me to the airport and I'm full of emotion, I can talk about that, about anything with that person, because chances are I'll never see them again. And I think I've always been drawn to those opportunities for spontaneous and acute candor that doesn't have wide ramifications. You know, nobody's gonna circle back and say, oh, you said to that guy on the subway in 1992 that XYZ, right? Like these are things that that you don't sort of have to deal with much fallout for. And I think that's a big part of why that intimacy exists, because you feel like you're almost like you're slipping a note into somebody's back pocket and then just walking away
I know that you have traveled a lot and written a lot about your travels and also living in other countries. Why in your travels do you think it's important to connect with people and places outside of your immediate circle of family and friends?
When I think about that question in my current life, I think about being a woman in the Middle East. My husband and I spend about 6 months out of the year in Egypt. And Egypt was a place that the first time I visited, I was just so confronted with gender issues and the differences between cultures, and felt very viewed as a Western woman and maybe seen unfavorably as being a Western woman on her own. And I think about the distance I've traveled since then, just by living in a small community in Luxor, Egypt, and talking to people and sitting around the fire and learning some Arabic. My Arabic teacher was a young woman who was pregnant at the same time as I was. So we would, you know, sit around and search for the words for heartburn in Arabic and connect on all these amazing levels. I think it just, people from the other side of the world and from vastly different cultures and upbringings can all of a sudden feel like family and just like the people you know from home. They can feel so familiar if you create the space for those stories and those connections and those one-on-one conversations, I think are incredibly important.
You also teach travel writing. I'm wondering how travel writing is different or similar to other kinds of writing, for example, creative nonfiction or just straight up journalism.
Well, more and more, I migrate away from the term travel writing and frame what I teach as writing about place, because I think travel writing is a very fraught space. I mean, we could probably talk for 40 minutes on that alone, about the responsibility that comes with writing about a culture that you weren't born into and a culture that, at least from the outset, is alien to you. But I think one of the things that was exciting to me about starting off assignment and opening the Letter to a Stranger column and working on the Letter to a Stranger book ultimately was that I could beckon poets and fiction writers and novelists, playwrights, all these different kinds of writers into this space in which they would be writing about place. And so it was almost like smashing the silo that is travel writing and saying, we all have stories about these moments in which we left home, were in an unfamiliar place, and then had moments of connection. Let's hear from everyone. Let's hear from our favorite fiction writers. Let's hear from, Lauren Groff has an essay in this book. I mentioned Rachel Yoder, another fiction writer, Peter Orner, so many extraordinary fiction writers in this book, and also reporters who tend to write, like Elizabeth Colbert tends to write more straightforward magazine features. It was so exciting to get a more personal essay from her. So I think what's exciting to me is kind of pushing back the walls and saying, like, this isn't an exclusive space just for people who've written for travel magazines. Everyone has a story that they can offer here.
What do you teach writers about how to observe place and people?
One thing that I would say I push as gospel in writing about place is to go alone to a place, to really extend yourself to the place. Divorce yourself from conversation with other people, obligation to other people. I mean, yes, there has been some great writing that's been done about travels with my dad or, you know, travels with a partner. But I think there's something, I think when we go to a new place, we really owe it our full quality of attention. And I think the best thing you can possibly do is go alone and devote yourself to your notes and your notebook, and to let observation beget observation beget observation. Like, just extend your noticing muscles and allow that spell to take over. I really am a believer that once you go to a place and start taking notes and commit to observations, that there's fierce momentum to that, that you can kind of get yourself into this fugue state that is so ripe for storytelling and can really enable you to notice granular details that otherwise in your daily landscape, or if you were walking down the street with another person, would just escape your notice.
Mm. You know, it strikes me in reading some of these stories about strangers that we're also learning quite a bit about the person writing the story, perhaps much more than about the stranger. How does a writer or any person become aware of their own cultural biases and assumptions?
Well, I think that's a lifelong process. I mean, I really do. One of the things I love about teaching writing is that I think it keeps me on my toes. It keeps me learning in a way that, like, I think we all know that about travel. Like, you know, you go somewhere new, of course, you have to learn the culture from scratch. You have to learn the language and the subway rules and the street directions, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's been more of a
alert system. Know it well, the radio's warning alarm. If you are participating in today's statewide earthquake drill as part of the West Coast Great Shakeout exercise, drop, cover, and hold now and follow your post-earthquake drill procedures. This is only a test. The following tones will conclude this test.
Teach Yale students who very often are very, let's say, kind of, they have this like sacrosanct attitude about like, oh, well, I got into this Ivy League school, I need to get every semester here. And I always say to them, the difference between 7 semesters at Yale and 8 semesters at Yale is negligible. But to be a human being who knows a foreign culture or a foreign language intimately changes who you are as a human being. So go abroad.
How do you think it changed you?
Oh gosh. I mean, I still think in Spanish sometimes. I only spent a few years of my life living in Spanish, but I find that language so beautiful. And there still are phrases that feel better made for the human experience, that feel like they enable me to better articulate a thought or an emotion. I think that, you know, when I read the news and hear about whether it's extreme rains in China or a financial collapse in Iceland, I'm so much more connected to those human realities and what that actually means to people, because I've walked streets in those places, because I've had conversations with citizens of those countries. So I think it feels pretty connected to my global empathy. And I think that's like an ongoing thing. I mean, we're just endlessly being hit with devastating news stories of places that are on the other side of the world. And I think I don't travel as much now because I'm a mom of a 15-month-year-old baby, but I will forever be drawing on that travel history, because those places just don't feel alien to me. They feel familiar because of the time that I've put in. And and I met my husband while I was in Egypt, so there's that. That was a game changer.
And it also strikes me that when you have names and faces for people, it changes how you understand the impact that different news events have. We can feel like we know that person or we know people in that place.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And whether it is, whether you're reading about somebody dying because their basement apartment was flooded or, you know, some sort of violence in a foreign country, like it's those individual human stories, those people, those faces that allow you that point of entry.
Mm-hmm. One thing I really appreciate about this collection of letters is the recognition of the importance of strangers and the importance of crossing paths with people that we may know only in a moment. Since we have been in a global pandemic, we haven't had as much opportunity to connect with strangers, not only in this country, but worldwide. What do you think the impact of that is?
I lament that. I have to say, Suzanne, that I even find it sad that when I'm in a drugstore and I am having a conversation with the person behind the counter, I can't see their smile or they can't see the nuances of what I'm doing with my face. I think that even when we do have encounters with strangers in the current moment, things feel a little compromised for lack of facial expression and also human touch. So I think this is such a different moment. And what are the ramifications of that? How do you quantify what we've lost? I don't know, but I can say that those rare moments in the past 2 years, when I have had those encounters with strangers, they feel like explosive and radiant. And to use a word that Leslie Jamison used in the introduction to the book, like a supernova of meaning, like just this comment that's coming at me. And the person who comes to mind actually is the woman in, I had our baby in Buffalo, New York, because that's, I still have healthcare in the States. I'm in the process of getting PR status in Canada, but we had our baby in Buffalo, New York, and we're renting a house. And, you know, when you're pregnant, like, it's such an amazing way to connect with strangers because everyone's like, oh, when are you due? And blah, blah, blah. And wants to tell you stories of their kids and wants to know the gender and blah, blah, blah. But I had so little of that. I mean, so little of that. And I lamented it. But there was a woman who was always out on her front stoop, two doors down from us, where we were renting a house. And she would see us go by with the baby, and she had this like raspy smoker's cough, and she would always call out something and was so friendly with us. And she's a part of the landscape of this rich period of my life. And I can't even tell you what her name is right now. And she symbolized to me just like the distant way that strangers were engaging during the pandemic, but also the way in which every now and again, someone would rear their head up and be like, I see you, person. Like, I'm not part of your germ circle. You will never know my name, but I see you and you see me. And here we are, human beings on this earth.
What do you hope people will take away from reading this book?
I hope that this book gives people space for reflection about their own lives. I think that there's something really magical about sitting down with a book in print, and this Letter to a Stranger project started online and it gained force online. And I'm so grateful to the internet for that. And we have an amazing archive of Letter to a Stranger stories on off assignment. But I think that there's going to be something really meaningful and singular about people taking this particular collection of stories and sitting with it and having a moment and thinking about who in their own lives might they write a letter to. And it's thrilling to me when people read a letter to a stranger or they hear the premise of the book and they say, you know, I have a story like that, or I have a bunch of stories like that. Let me start and think about that. And I think that we're so used to thinking about the major players in our life when we reflect. And, you know, even if you look at obituaries and the way they're formatted, you know, it starts with family members and then sometimes other people are mentioned, but we're so conditioned to think about the people who've impacted us as being these big nameable public figures. And I think the reality is a lot of us are shaped at pretty pivotal moments by people who aren't nameable and who maybe don't even have a face that we can sketch in memory, but who made their mark. And I think that's a really exciting project for all of us to take into our own lives and histories.
Today, my guest has been essayist, teacher, and editor Colleen Kinder, talking about her book, Letter to a Stranger, Essays to the Ones That Haunt Us. If listeners want to find out more about your work, where can they go?
Well, I have a website, as do most all writers these days, and I also continue to do work for the Letter to a Stranger column at Off Assignment. I'm the executive director there, and we love hearing from readers of the Letter to a Stranger column, and we love getting submissions. We still publish Letter to a Stranger essays and plan to for the foreseeable future. So be in touch and send us your stories.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Suzanne. It was a pleasure.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. Mavis Gallant, who died in 2014 at the age of 91, was a Canadian short story writer who spent most of her life in France. During her lifetime, she had 118 stories published in The New Yorker, which made her one of the magazine's most published writers. Along the way, she did write two novels, but it was because of her shorter fiction that she was very much a writer's writer. A very private person, she only rarely gave interviews, but she did go on a book tour for her short story collection Across the Bridge, and it's then, on October 6, 1993, that Richard A. Lupoff and I had a chance to speak with her. Wikipedia notes that her subject was frequently fascism, in particular about what she called, quote, the small possibilities in people, which leaned them toward fascism. In a roundabout way, she discusses that in this interview.
You live in Paris, but you were born in Montreal. Mm-hmm. It said in the biographical material you went to 17 French and English-speaking boarding schools, and during that period you developed a passion for literature.
But not boarding schools. I had some boarding schools, but they were just public schools. I was given books when I was a small child, and I read all the classics in English. I read in French, but I preferred English, so I wrote in English.
Why 17 schools? Were you that much of a thug?
No, I wasn't that much of a thug. My father died when I was very small. My mother married again, and I was rather shunted around.
And you moved to Paris after the war in 1950. And you've been there ever since.
Well, I've been in Europe ever since, yes. I wasn't in Paris the whole time. At first, I moved around, which was much easier to do in those days. I had a little typewriter and a suitcase, you know, very small. And it was easy. I had no money. The less money you had, the easier it was to move around, because you just got in a third-class carriage and away you went.
When you were in Montreal, you were a journalist. Did you continue the journalism in Europe?
No. The first winter, I did a few things because I had no money. Then I didn't do anything, any form of journalism for 18 years because I wanted to really just do fiction. Then my diary of the 1968 student riots was published by The New Yorker, and then I began to do, I saw that it was all right, I could do it, and I did some reviewing, and I did different things, yes.
How was Paris in 1968? Was it as extraordinary as they say?
It was utterly extraordinary. I thought it was the Commune. And it was very stupid of me because not much was happening outside Paris. But the reason why I started to keep a journal so intensely, I thought the newspapers weren't reporting it properly from the first day, and I thought it was the Commune. I thought it was a great, great, great change. I couldn't believe it, and I must tell you, I was very happy about it.
Well, we hear about it from the time that the students actually began their revolt in 68. Mm-hmm. How far back did the seeds of it go? I mean, did it go back to the beatnik movement of the 50s, do you
No,
think?
Everyone was absolutely astonished. But the student movement itself began in America and in Italy in 68. It didn't start in France. But there, as things always do, they become legendary. There's a philosophical basis. They don't calm down all that easily either. And there was, you know, to live in a city where everything, absolutely everything, country where everything comes to a standstill is extraordinary. Where you can't post a letter, you can't go to a movie, you can't. There, nothing is working, and that's remarkable.
What was the government doing that during that period?
Wringing its hands, and De Gaulle was had left, went to Germany to see if he could get back up from the army, and was told they wouldn't fire on people, they wouldn't do it. It was as touch and go as that. He was ready to.
In the United States, the student movement, in some respects, gave rise to, in many people's minds, I'm not sure how true it is, to the Reagan years, and in France, to Giscard d'Estaing and afterward. Do you see a comparison between the
two? Oh, there was an enormous change afterwards. The relationship, there really was. This isn't just romantic nonsense. They voted in right after the riots, the most conservative government they had until now. Now it's even more conservative. But the relationship between parents and children changed almost overnight. Young people were not like young people here. They were very held by their families, and suddenly they were out. They weren't coming home. They were fighting. It was extraordinary. It's never been the same since. And the school system changed. The university system changed. That really did change.
So everything was more or less 19th century in a sense, and then it just shifted into the
20th? I always looked on French young people as little senile old men. And I looked down, they were 17, they were 18, they were doing their homework, the mother was standing there with the book. They had little, I always saw them with little thin arms, you know, carrying these books, oui, madame, you know, very, and suddenly they became something else.
But here in America, we've always had the image of France in general and Paris in particular as being ultimately cosmopolitan and sophisticated.
Well, I don't see the contradiction. What do you mean?
This sort of repression, the notion of the little stick-like...
Well, that's middle class, you know, that was the way the people were brought up. It doesn't stop them from being sophisticated in their tastes in art or books or whatever.
Mavis Gallant, you deal with these sorts of people in your books to a very great degree and in your short stories. Okay. Certainly in the stories in Across the Bridge, you are dealing with those sorts of people. The sense I get is that you have a great feel for that era.
Well, I remember it. That's when I arrived, and things were like that. I knew a young woman in 1950 when I got there who became engaged to a man, and she didn't know if she was going to marry him or his cousin. Her father said, I've had an offer for you, you know, just like a horse, and I'm not forcing you to take it, but I advise you to take it because I'm hard up. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. You've got two other sisters. And he said the family name, and she didn't know if it was this man or his cousin, and she just accepted because she couldn't see anything else to do. And that was not only within my lifetime. It was, you know, I was there.
Mademoiselle Diaz de Corta deals with a young woman who comes into a home. She's obviously a modern woman, yet the woman she's staying with seems very much like the mothers of these pre-68
French
people.
But the question is that the young woman who comes to Paris looking for a job is obviously Portuguese, obviously. And the woman who takes her in is is motherly. She would look after, but she can't stop making racist cracks. It's in her. It's in her. She can't stop doing it. It's second nature. That's what the story's really about.
I must say that I was very struck by the way small points become magnified and rendered very important, at least symbolically important, in your works. And I'm thinking in particular of the different regional accents of speech which are mentioned in France, and then in the Montreal stories with which the book opens and closes, the emphasis on such fine points as an occasional slip of pronouncing as if it were the letter D, where it should be TH.
Yes.
How important is this?
I must think it's important, or I wouldn't be doing it. And I do listen. I have an ear. And
it identifies people.
I can, yes. I'm not as good with American voices now because I don't live here, but I used to be able to imitate any of you.
Well, it seems in the book, in the story, Mademoiselle Diaz de Corta, but it also runs throughout your book, people seem very deaf to what other people are doing and thinking. And this is in that story, but also in the Fenton Child, it's as if nobody is really listening to one another.
Do you think so?
Yeah,
I'm not aware of that. In the Fenton Child, there's a mystery.
There is a mystery. And the solution is
simple.
It's pretty obvious from the early pages of it. But it seems there that, and to some degree, I think in the Montreal stories, everybody is enclosed in their own little world, and peering out beyond that world seems difficult for them.
Are you objecting to this?
Oh, no, I'm just statement. It's a statement.
Well, I can't help you because I can't analyze the work. I could analyze if it were somebody else's, but I can't write and analyze it at the same time. It's impossible for me. I really don't know. To me, it's a book, when I reread it, because I had to time stories that I'm going to be reading, you know, while I'm over here, and I thought it seemed to me a book about language.
More than anything else?
More than anything, it was odd, yes.
In fact, there is a story, please remind me of the title, about a professor who spends years in a
Kingdom Come, that's my favorite.
Kingdom Come, that's a wonderful little
story.
It's
my favorite. Yes.
It borders on fantasy in a way.
Yes, it's a parable.
Would you talk about, well, again, you can't analyze your own work, but would you, if possible, talk about the creative process, the ideation that went into that remarkable story?
All short stories begin with an image. You know, you see someone, and I saw this man standing on a stage in Helsinki and with only 9 people in the audience and bringing them something absolutely remarkable, an Alophilian language that no one had ever heard or knew anything about, and a society nobody knew anything about. And they all get up and file out. That was the first image I had.
Because nobody cared.
Because nobody in Europe cared. I wrote that story just obviously before the Yugoslav War, because I say in it there are no wars in Europe. And it was also before they had the court cases in America where children denied or chose or refused their parents, because I mentioned it. But I imagined that. I imagined it as something so fantastic that children would recognize their parents instead of parents recognizing the children, that it never occurred to me such a thing come to pass. I wrote it, I think, about 89, something like that, in 90.
Do you read much in the way of short stories, other people's?
Well, I read in the way most writers read, just whatever's around, you know. I read an awful lot of short stories when I was adolescent. I read Chekhov in English in the Constance Garnett translation over and over and over. I read Maupassant. I could read French, you know, so that was easy. But I don't know that I prefer them to novels. No, I think I began to write short stories, to tell you the truth. First of all, I was fascinated by the New Yorker when I was young, and because at that time the best of fiction was there, so I thought it had to be that or nothing. And I sent them a story out of the blue. I was a newspaper reporter, and that was how we got going. But after that, when I went to Europe, now I decided to try and live on my work, which was a quixotic thing to do. I wrote short stories because I had no money. I couldn't sit down for 18 months and think about a novel. And I had to have money so I could lived for the next 2-3 months, you see. That was, it was no more deep or penetrating than that. That was all. I was hard up.
What do you see as the difference between Canadian, French-Canadian, and French culture?
I would think they were utterly different except for a faraway root. You know, I think syntax is thought, and you don't think the same way. I think that they're Americans who speak a very old French, although it's irritating. I'm irritating them by saying this, and I shouldn't because it's not my intention. But who are American? When you see them in Europe, you see how American they are.
They perceive themselves to be French, but you would perceive them.
At a point, sometimes they perceive themselves American too, and they get pretty irritated. And they have the same problems in France that I have in England as people from an ex-colony. I'm very irritated by the English. I don't put up with anything. I have a chip on my shoulder. I'm as rude as can be, and they are like that with the French very often. They say, "What do you mean you can't understand me?" Or you're in England, someone says, "Where are you from?" I say, "What do you mean, where am I from?" Yeah. It's stupid. But.
You're listening to an interview with the late short story writer Mavis Gallant, who died in 2014 at the age of 91. This was recorded while she was on tour for her collection Across the Bridge on October 6, 1993. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
The stories, the Canadian stories in your book, are for the most part, perhaps entirely written from the viewpoint of French Canadians.
I don't know why that happened. I think it's just something I'm remembering. That period of the 40s is when I was a reporter. And at that time, they didn't want women on newspapers, and I had a career only because I could speak French, and it was a French city, and I could go to a French press conference and write the thing in English. You know, I had that advantage. And I did know those. Really, you can trust me on that. I did know them. I went to a French... I was in a French convent at the age of 4. Those are the children I played with. I knew I was the only English Protestant of my generation to whom this very strange thing occurred. And I feel absolutely reliable when I'm writing them. I know I'm not going to make a mistake. And I like them.
In these stories, we see the English Protestants, Canadians, through the eyes of French Catholic Canadians.
But that's what's interesting, isn't it?
They come across as very cold and not very bright. Or do I misread you?
Perhaps. But from her point of view, they would be. And of course, they were a very Philistine community. Why do you think I wanted to get out? I put it to you rhetorically.
You feel more at home than in Europe.
I had Europe on the brain, but it came from my reading. It came from my reading. Everything that I read and all the music I listened to, everything seemed to come from Europe. I had no idea. I knew about the war. I was stupid. I was in it. But I didn't realize how dreadful, how much they hated each other.
The English and the French?
No, Europeans among themselves.
Oh, all the Europeans.
I tended to idealize.
What about the preponderance of American TV and junk culture in Europe? And I'm thinking of Euro Disney, but I'm also thinking of Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park.
Oh, so what? Come on. It's not... I think that the fight they're putting up now with the GATT about culture is right to some extent, because the French don't want the television to become like the German and the Italian. And I don't blame them. However, what they produce isn't all that thrilling. You know, it's pretty. You know, she goes to the window, she looks out, she stands there for a long time looking out. He's back there, and he's going to pour a glass of water over her head, but he never quite does it. And
it sounds almost like a New Yorker story. New Yorker had been at one time the great bastion of the so-called slice of life school of writing. Is that school still alive?
You'd better judge it. The American stories, you judge America, it's your business.
We interviewed a very successful, incredibly successful American writer by the name of Anne Rice, who writes, Okay, she writes novels.
Vampire novels,
very gothic vampire novels.
Just signed a $17 million contract with her publisher.
Okay. She started complaining to us, and I'd like to hear your response to this, that the era of the fantastic novel was somehow coming into its own, and the era of what she called pedestrian realism was declining, that this had been an aberration in literature.
Well, what do you mean by pedestrian realism? You mean like Jane Austen? I mean, what do you mean?
I think she was referring to the mundane lives of everyday people living out their fears, hopes, and prejudices. That's the sense that I get.
But it can't be over because they're still publishing it. That is, you know, if you've ever looked at students' work, and they begin. I only did it 1 year at a university, and I was amazed at the. It's obviously their own families and so forth. The violence. I wouldn't call it mundane pedestrian, and I often said, well, where did you hear people talking that way to their children? Where did you hear that language? I don't agree about mundane. I don't think there's such a thing as a mundane life. I think you take anybody off the street, life is interesting. It depends how you look at it, how you approach it, the kind of questions you ask the person, what you bring out of them. There's even someone who at 18 does nothing more. It's not mundane. There's no such thing. You don't have to be bitten by a vampire to have experience of life. It's thrust upon you.
According to some of the literature your publisher sent us, you've had very long, ongoing relationships with editors. Joe Fox at Random House.
30 years.
Danny Maneker at The New Yorker.
Well, it was really William Maxwell I had for 25 years, and he replaced him. And I figured out the other day it added up to 20 years. Yes, you know, am I a gypsy to change?
Well, do you think this is common?
I don't know. I've certainly changed a lot in England, where I'm a bit more difficult to deal with, and I change constantly with Americans. Why change?
When these editors, these different editors, mm-hmm. not the same ones, come to you, do they want to change your prose at all?
Never.
They never want to do anything?
No, well, when I was young and I had William Maxwell, the New Yorker then was very high-handed. And they would do various things, but that stopped. And he was a remarkable editor, you know who I'm talking about. For a whole year, I didn't know he was the William Maxwell. I didn't know he was the writer. He not only was not in competition with his writers, he was extremely, he just never mentioned. It was a year before I realized that the author of The Folded Leaf was the man I was working with. A novel I worshipped, you know, and that was that man.
I don't know if Ross was before your time.
Ross took my first story.
He did. Did you ever meet him?
No, I didn't meet Mr. Ross, but he accepted my first story.
How about Sean? Did you ever meet him?
Of course, yes.
What was he like?
We wrote, he called me Miss Gallant, and I once said, well, if you're going to do that bit, it's actually technically Mrs., but it didn't matter, it was Miss, and he signed William Shaw. The day he left, I had a letter. He wrote me a letter within the week, Dear Mavis, Love, Bill. And it had been Mr. Shaw and Miss Tiddly Push, whatever I'm called, for the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, halfway through the 80s. We fought like wildcats because he edited my 1968 journals personally, and we did fight by long distance. It's the only man I ever shouted. I went through a divorce without raising my voice. I shouted at him on the phone. He said, well, we're only trying to help. And I shouted, stop trying to help me.
What about Tina Brown? Did you have any contact with her?
Oh, yes. We've talked on the phone.
What do you think of her changes at The New Yorker?
I can't judge it, because the one thing that I would never do in any circumstances is say something was necessarily better before. As a fiction writer, I do mind having the fiction squeezed into as if, I think, the you know, is about as much attention paid to fiction as a guppy would pay. But it hasn't changed my relationship with the magazine, no. in as a professional sense, and I've never met her. I shall be meeting her now.
Do you see yourself writing for different other publications?
I don't know. It's never come up. It might. I might end up ever writing for you. Do you broadcast your stories?
We sometimes do, yes.
Yeah, well, there you are. It's my future.
In the same context, have you ever considered writing in other languages than English?
No, I'm absolutely, that would be a tour de force. I won't do it. I won't go near it. The only writer who brought that off successfully was Beckett. I mean successfully. And even there's something, in my view, wrong with the French. It's cold classic French. And when you read what he wrote in English, you hear the Irish. There's even a kind of relaxed, slangy tone, and the dated slang places his generation in Irish. In French, it's cold running water, and even when it's the same thing.
Have you read your own works after they were translated?
Oh, I certainly do, because I check all the proofs in French. In Paris, I give readings in French from the translations, yes.
A number of writers see literature as some kind of political statement, and a number of writers say that literature has nothing to do with politics.
I don't see how anything you write cannot be political. It is implicitly political. And when you meet writers who say, I'm not interested in politics, this thing is remote from me. I'm not talking about poets. I'm talking about prose writers. This thing is remote from me. Take it from me, the right wing. And they don't know it.
Can you go
further?
Well,
but you discover it in conversation, talking to them. They say, oh, politics, horror, you know, I don't want anything to do with it. They're all a bunch of this and that. And then, you know, I write only for aesthetic reasons, and you talk to them, you realize that the aesthetic reasons are very conservative ones. And that's a political statement right away.
So even when they're avoiding politics, they're saying something?
Anything written is political, except thank you for the lovely lunch. That can pass. Well,
so Across the Bridge is a political collection of stories.
It's implicit, but in the lives they live in the country. I'm very fussy about the background and the exactly what's happening. There's no never never land for me, and so it's implicit in the background.
So you are making statements even as you talk about marriage and troubles.
Making statements. I don't know. What's it?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to pin you down, and you're not pinnable, but which is good. At one point, you said in an interview, when the question came up, you write about marriage and troubled relationships. Your response was, "What else is there
to trouble than trouble?" I don't know.
Well,
if I put the question, it's up to you to answer. It's not up to me.
Well, but when you say, "What else is there?"
Well, I might have been being flip.
Okay.
It's possible. I don't remember this exchange at all.
Because certainly if you're talking marriage and troubled relationships, that's politics is, I guess, an element of that, but it's not.
Well, the very time you live in is political. And when I don't think you can live a complete life exempt from what is going on around you unconsciously reacting to it. I don't mean who am I going to vote for. It's something completely, completely out.
When you said before that the aesthetic, the person interested in aesthetics, when you talk to them and...
No one would ever say that, but it's implicit,
yeah.
Yes.
That they actually are conservative. What do you think that means?
I don't know, but it's something I've noticed. It's just something I've noticed. I'm an ex-reporter, and I report what I notice.
Because it would tend to imply that the conservative is somehow perhaps ignoring or boxing politics and putting it in a back pocket.
I really don't know, but it is something I have noticed, particularly when people are very disdainful and say, moi, la politique, jamais, quelle horreur, you know, how awful, I don't want it. You get to a conversation, you discover it's always someone very conservative.
One other question then, because you do mention your background as a journalist, to what extent would you agree with the statement that all fiction is really a form of reporting?
To me, yes, but other writers would tell you something completely different. Right. To me, it is reporting. It's reporting on people, it's reporting on what you see when you look out the window, except that you you should know a little bit more if you're a writer, the probabilities of what are happening. But there is a difference. As a journalist, you have no right to say what somebody was thinking. I absolutely disapprove of that. But in fiction, you have the right, and isn't it lovely? You can put yourself in someone else's place, but it's reporting.
You've been listening to an interview with the late Mavis Gallant, who died at the age of 91 in February 2014. New York Review Books Classics has published several volumes of her stories, most notably the collected stories, which feature 52 examples of her best work, and Paris Stories, curated by Michael Ondaatje. Across the Bridge is available in an ebook edition from Amazon. My co-host for the interview was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. This interview was digitized, remastered, and edited in August 2020. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky under the auspices of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Northern California.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 21 de octubre del 2021. La Administración de Alimentos y Medicamentos otorgó el miércoles una autorización de uso de emergencia para las inyecciones de refuerzo de las vacunas COVID de Moderna y Johnson & Johnson. La FDA también aprobó una estrategia de combinación para que las personas reciban una vacuna de refuerzo que no estaba en su serie principal. Mientras tanto, la Casa Blanca presentó el miércoles su plan para vacunar a millones de niños entre 5 y 11 años, a la vez que la vacuna Pfizer